Blog Talk Radio.
Brief message, and I'll get back to you very soon.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and I bear witness that Muhammad is His messenger, and I bear witness that the Honorable Mr. Louis Farrakhan is our divine reminder. And I would like to greet the listening audience, those of you who are joining us by phone, and those of you who are already asking me questions in chat. Thank you so very much. We haven't gotten started yet. I would like to greet you in our greeting words of peace, assalamu alaikum, meaning peace be unto you. And I want to welcome you all back to Nation Building Presents. And, of course, this week our topic is marriage and addiction. Who are you really married to? And I don't know what happened to my other panelists. Brother Khalil Muhammad was supposed to join us, but Student Minister James will be on soon. But, of course, we do have a special guest with us tonight, one that I am so honored to present. And so I'm going to allow him to introduce himself and tell us a little bit about himself. It is my honor to present to you Bishop Z.T. Davis from St. Louis, Missouri. Good evening, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me, Sister Ziza. How are you tonight?
I am blessed. I am blessed by God's grace and permission. And so, Bishop Davis, if you would, just take a few minutes and tell us something about yourself, about your background, and what is it that you do?
Sure. First of all, let me say thank you, not only to you, but to your listeners. Thank you for having me. I know you say it's an honor for you to have me, but it's an honor and a privilege to be one of your panelists tonight. My name is Bishop Zachariah Davis. I am the senior pastor of the Friendly Missionary Baptist Church, which is now known as the City of Faith, here in St. Louis, Missouri. And I am a Houstonian. I was born and raised in Houston, Texas. Lived there for a little bit over 30 years. And about 4 or 5 years ago, the Lord called me to move here to St. Louis to pastor a church. So we've been here.
Now, I have to ask, what side of town are you from?
I'm from Southside. I grew up in Sunnyside, Third Ward area.
Okay, we're in the same hood. All right. Now,
yeah.
Did you go to Jones, Worthen, or Yates? Which one?
Everyone asked that. I did not go to neither one of those schools. I went to the High School for Performing and Visual Arts.
Oh, okay, okay, HSCVA. Okay, well,
yeah, I went to HSCVA.
Say.
Yeah. so yeah, we're here in St. Louis, Missouri. We've been here almost 5 years now, and we are so excited about the work that we're doing here with the church that we pastor in. And again, like I said, I am honored to be one of your panelists this evening. To talk about this subject that you are bringing to light.
Yes, sir. Well, you know, Bishop Davis, hopefully our panelists will be joining us soon. But if not, you and I will roll on. You know, that's a Houston thing. We'll just keep the show going. But
absolutely.
The reason why I brought this topic to the surface, number one, it's one that many of us avoid talking about publicly, especially if it's something that we have experienced. If you have ever used drugs, had a severe addiction of any kind, and you've been able to overcome that, you have one or two kinds of people. You have those who use it as a testimony, and you have those that kind of hide it in shame and guilt. But oftentimes we don't get an opportunity to speak with the true victims of substance abuse. And a lot of times it is the spouses and the other family members and the children who suffer.
Sure.
And so I have counseled. I've been a drug counselor, a marriage counselor for over 26 years now. And I've encountered a lot of women in particularly, but very few men, but women in particularly, I have encountered a lot of women who have, you know, been separated. Their marriage has crumbled due to substance abuse. And so this is something that I want to discuss publicly, to offer some help, to offer some resolution, and then talk about marriage and talk about those vows, forsaking all others, you know, for better, for worse, and sickness and health, for rich and for poor, till death do we part. And so when you are challenged with substance abuse in the marriage, how do you get through that? Because that is one heck of a hurdle to cross. And I've lived it, and I tell you, I didn't make it. I didn't make it over that hurdle,
okay.
You know, but
sure.
You have a lot of people who are striving to deal with this on a daily basis, and they suffer in silence. So by the grace of God, we'll be able to bring some hope and some help you know, to these families by sharing information. And before we start, Bishop Davis, I just want to share, if you don't mind, some statistics
sure.
that I found. And this was something I found under Narcotics Anonymous. It says 23.9 million Americans aged 12 years and up are users of illicit drugs, and they name marijuana, cocaine, heroin, hallucinogens, inhalants, psychotherapeutic drugs, and, of course, pain relievers. I thought for a long time that alcohol was the most common used drug, but now since it is legal medicinally in some states, marijuana has become the most common used drug. And I think what is most disturbing to me of these statistics, now we're talking about the black community. I'm not sure about the accuracy. And usually this site is very, very accurate, but it says 40% of school-age African-American children, grades 8 through 12, use illicit drugs. Now, we're just going to stop right there. And let me just tell you, they say that 4.4% of them between grades 8 and 12 are using cocaine. 32% of them are using alcohol, and 24% of them are using a combination of alcohol, marijuana, and cocaine. And then out of that 40, 24.2% of those users are black males. So, Bishop Davis, what's going on in our community with these drugs?
Well, first of all, those are really some alarming numbers. That 40% number in our secondary schools, you know, and even our elementary schools, that is really alarming. But let me start by saying I am a product of a drug-addicted mother. My mother has been on drugs for better of maybe, I'd say, 30-some-odd years. I was raised by my grandmother, and all I could remember on a regular basis is my mother being on drugs and how it affected our family, our households, my other sisters and brothers. It really always kept us at a, I guess the best way I could say it, always kept us sitting on the edge because we never knew what was going to happen or we never knew what phone call we were going to get concerning her. So I am very well familiar with what it's like to have a family member that is a drug addict. I've never experienced having a spouse, so I know we're dealing with marriages and spouses, but I think it's equally important. I'm glad that you mentioned that both the spouse and the children, because the children experience just as much heartache and pain behind this as a spouse would, because no child or no spouse wants to see their parent or spouse on drugs, because the drugs always make them act in, you know, the most terrible ways, whether it's theft, whether it's mistreatment of the spouse. Because these drugs, you know, make them act out of character. So it always has kept us on edge as a family, and I'm pretty sure with the average black family it does. And the average black family always has at least one person in their family that is addicted to drugs. So in regards to these numbers, I guess they are alarming, but maybe a little hard for me to believe that it's that high. But in the same token, when the average black family has at least one person on drugs in the family, maybe not so. Maybe not so hard to believe. As a community, I believe what we need to do is faith leaders of all different faiths, you know, people of all different faiths, we have to learn how to rally around our children. You know, the old African proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. You know, we have to learn how to rally around our children. And when we see them going down these paths and taking these routes that are not, that will not, you know, do anything to further their future, then, you know, we as adults, whether they're our children or not, we need to be bold enough to say something about it. And oftentimes, that's usually the problem in the Black community. We believe very strongly in the phrase, I'm a mind my own business. That's not my child. That's not my child. You know, it don't affect me, so I'm a mind my own business. Well, it does affect you because it affects the Black community. And anything that affects the Black community, it affects all of us, not just one of us. And so we have to learn how to rally around our children and speak up when we see them doing things that are not right. I could be riding down the street here in St. Louis, and at one time, you know, thankfully we're not at the top of the list this year, but at one time we had one of the highest murder rates in the country per capita. I can ride down the street, and if I see a child smoking that I think is underage, I'm going to stop and tell them to stop. You know, if I see a fight going on, I'm going to stop and break it up. But more of us have to be involved in that, because just one person or two people or a couple of people are not going to be enough to make a great impact into slowing down some of these bad trends that we see amongst our culture. And so if we know that drugs is a part of our culture, then we ought to not be all right with allowing drug houses to just be in our community. We ought to not be okay with allowing people to set up shop in the areas and the suburb, I'm sorry, in the areas and the communities we live in. So we have to take a more hands-on approach and not be scared to do so. You know, I chastise the children that live next door to me just like they're my own children, because I want them to understand I have your best interest at heart, just like I have my own children's best interest at heart. So I think we as adults,
right,
we have to take more of a responsibility to speak up and rally around our children, and maybe we can get some of these high, you know, drug abuse rates that you just read to me, because, I mean, that's alarming that those rates are that high in elementary and secondary schools.
Yes, sir. And, you know, nationally among the Black race, they say that 21.3% of all Black women, now they're talking about all Black women, and they're ranging them from the age of 15 years and up, 21.3% of Black women use illicit drugs compared to 39.4% of Black males. And
wow.
I'm like, really?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've been in this field a long time, and it just seems like the numbers keep getting higher and higher. And I want to talk about the marriage, the family component. I am going to get to that. I don't want people to think that we're not going to talk about that. But in order to really address this issue, we really have to address the issue of, number one, our community. And why is our community so overran with drugs? What is going on in society that makes drug use an acceptable form of healing or medicating, so to speak? Because those of us who work in the clinical practicum, we are aware that they are medicating. A lot of family members might not know that. A lot of family members probably say they're just a bad person, they're just no good. But oftentimes they are medicating from a hurt and a pain. And we as Black people, in particularly, we don't really seek counseling. for, you know, any emotional traumas that we may have had. We are taught that, you know, some of our boys are taught if you cry, if you bellyache about something, you're a sissy, you know. And so there's a lot of suppression of emotions there. And a lot of times that leads to drug use along with peer pressure and other things. But more so than anything is self-medicating. And so when we talk about a healing, Bishop Davis, what can our people do better than use drugs to address some of those things that ail them?
Well, wow, you know, that's such a broad yet narrow question all at the same time. You know, amongst the African-American community, the black community, of course, our faith has always been our strong backbone for the most of us. And again, you know, just faith in general, whether we are Christians, Muslims, it doesn't matter. Our faith in the black community has always been a strong backbone for us. The average African American, is someone who believes in some type of higher power than themselves. So that's always been an outlet for us, our faith, what we believe in, this higher power that's able to bring us some type of deliverance, you know, in some type of way. However, sometimes the pains of life are so difficult. You know, and it's funny you ask this question because I've never really taken time to ask my own mother, why did you do drugs? What was it that made you turn to them? I've never taken time to ask her that. We've had tons of going back and forth with her about, please stop, please consider us, you know, but I never recall a conversation where we took the time and said, okay, Clarice, that's her name, okay, Clarice, why did you turn to drugs? What happened in your life that made you want to go down this route? What hurt did you feel? And you're absolutely right. Usually it's some type of hurt that they're running from or some type of hurt that was done to them, that this pain that they don't know how to get rid of, or they don't know how to manage, and so they turn to some type of substance because it gives them a temporary relief from whatever this pain, this emotional pain may be. But we never took time, and again, to this day, I don't recall us ever taking time to ask her, how did you get here, and why did you get here? I think that's so important. So that's one of the questions that we probably need to stop and ask when we do have a family member who's on drugs. We need to ask them, why did you do this? And not in a judgmental fashion. You know, why did you turn to drugs? What was it that made you decide that your pain was so overwhelming that you needed to do something to medicate? Because that's what drugs are, you know, a type of medication. You know, that you needed to do something to medicate yourself or over-medicate yourself and then become addicted to it. What was going on? So, you know, I think you're right on. We have to slow down and ask these questions. And while these questions are painful and sometimes they may not want to answer the question, in order to deal with the fact that, hey, you're on drugs, we want to get you off drugs, in order to deal with that, you're going to have to answer those hard questions. We can't be afraid to ask those hard questions.
Yes, sir, absolutely. And we are going to, like I said, I want to remind the audience, we are going to get to marriage. But I just want people to understand what addiction is. And it is a condition of being dependent upon a substance or an activity, or it's a bad habit, and that's in case we have some younger people listening. Also, though, you know, we want to talk about the disease process because addiction is a disease.
Sure.
And,
absolutely.
You know, and it affects people in a biological, neurological, genetic way, whether
sure.
the sources are from the environment or whether they genetically, you know, obtain this addiction through, you know, in the womb while the mother was pregnant. But this is a type of dysfunction that you have to recondition yourself to come out of. And the process of addiction is really mental. And what
yeah.
happens is that even in the 12-step programs, they tell you that you have to resolve, excuse me, to a higher power.
Sure.
Because that
sure.
is how powerful the drug is. And so that's
mm-hmm.
why I titled this show, Marriage and Addiction, Who Are You Really Married To? Because when we talk about commitment and we talk about vows, forsaking all others, you know, for better, for worse, keeping your duty to that individual person, well,
mm-hmm.
then you have to think about using a drug. It's almost like infidelity. Because
sure.
you go all out of your way to submit and to make sure that you have that drug. You spend all the money. You bend over backwards. You jump through hoops. You
sure.
do whatever you got to do to get that drug,
yeah.
and you abandon the family. And so, Bishop Davis, I'm going to ask you, when a couple or a young sister, a young brother comes to you and say, hey, my spouse is addicted to whatever,
sure.
what is your advice to them?
Well, there are a number of things that I would say. Number one, I'm a clinical pastoral educator, which means that I counsel on a clinical basis also. I've been a drug and substance abuse and a sexual abuse counselor for the past 10 years now. So I do a lot of counseling of a lot of different individuals, whether they be couples, single, as far as drug abuse, sex abuse, so on and so forth. One of the things that I would say, first of all, is a lot of these individuals need people who can give them not only spiritual help, but professional help. And, for example, in my faith tradition, many pastors now are seeking out professional licenses in order so that they can better counsel individuals who come to them with issues. And so now there are a lot of pastors who are going to get counseling degrees, who are going to be state certified to counsel, you know, with a state license, because they want to be able to offer more to their congregation members than just the spiritual side. However, you know, if an individual was to come to me, you know, of course, I would always start with, you know, the higher power and how the higher power can assist them according to my faith tradition. You know, this is what God will do for you according to his word and what I believe, and do my best to try to articulate it to them. However, that may not be enough for that particular moment. Because when you have an individual who's looking for their next fix, telling them Jesus is going to fix it for them may not be good enough. it may not be good enough. So I have to make sure that I have every tool possible to my accessibility, so that if they need to go to a drug treatment center, or if they need to go through a detox, I need to have every tool at my grasp, so that not only that I can give them Jesus, but I can also give them some professional help also. And I think coupled with all of that together, then you can see people, you know, come out of some of these terrible situations. My church is in the inner city portion of St. Louis. you know, the drug rate in where my church is very high. So we have a lot of churches in this area where pastors are banding together to try to combat drug houses, prostitution, you know, and among other things that kind of all tail on with drugs or with drug habits, you know, making sure that abandoned houses are not open, that they're boarded up, because we know that's again for drug users to go in and stay and live and so on and so forth. But along with that, Sister Aziza, is that we also offer special spiritual counseling, where we have a chaplain that is always available 24 hours a day at somebody's church, so that, you know, if there's a sister or a brother who's walking the street and they decide they want to turn in and get some type of help, well, we got a chaplain available 24 hours that can come anywhere within the quadrants of our churches and offer counseling. And then, you know, if they want to go ahead on and turn themselves into a drug treatment center, then we work in close collaboration with drug treatment centers in the area so that they can get the best quality help possible, and we have a hand in it. So if someone came to me, you know, asking for help, of course, yes, I'm going to always start with the spiritual side, you know, because that's just my call, that's my job, that's my profession. However, I wouldn't use it alone. I have to use both spiritual and secular resources to help individuals overcome these types of situations in their lives.
Yes, sir, absolutely. And at this time, Student Minister James Muhammad has finally joined us. And so, of course, I want to take the time to present my dear brother. He's also the host of our live study group, Put On the New Man. So it is my privilege, honor, and pleasure to present to you, not introduce, because everyone knows who he is by now, Student Minister James Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, sir.
Wa alaikum salam, Sister Gidget, and to your panelists, and of course, your listening audience, I wish to apologize for being so late. I happen to have had to do a master reset on my phone, lost all my, or at least this call-in number. And so, well, be that as it may, please accept my apologies. And I'm so thankful to Allah and, of course, to you to be a part of this show. So thank you all. And I don't know exactly where you all are, what question you might be on, if any specific question you are on. But if you can bring me up to speed, I'd appreciate
yes,
it. Thank
sir.
You, dear sister.
Yes, sir. Well, I was just asking Bishop Davis, and this is Bishop Zachariah Davis from St. Louis, about, you know, the advice that he would give to someone if they come to him and say that their spouse is addicted. And, of course, he was expressing that, you know, he has to come from a spiritual side, but also you have to have a clinical educational component to also address them when they're fighting that dilemma. So since you're here, Brother James, I can ask you, you know, because I know you do auditing and counseling as well. So when a spouse comes to you and say, my husband, my wife is addicted, what do you tell them?
Well, first of all, let me preface any statements with the name of Allah, invoking the help of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. And I thank him for my teacher, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. And I want to also thank my co-panelists on this show. It's an honor to be a part of this panel. And I want to say, dear Bishop, that I'm in total agreement with you regarding the spiritual component, inviting or suggesting to the person that there is a spiritual component to the malady, to the affliction, that must be addressed. But there is a clinical, and in addition, there is a clinical process that needs to be gone through. Because the spiritual aspect is that which will connect the person to the source of all power, which, of course, is the Most High, the Supreme Being. And that connection must be made before any healing can take place. The spiritual connection to which I'm referring specifically involves the relationship between God and man, knowing that God has created us in his image and after his likeness. It not only means we look like him as such, but it also means that the power that he has is the same power potentially we can wield.
Yeah.
The Honorable Elijah Muhammad has taught us in our lessons that we are all God's children of the Most High God. And as such, we have access to that same power, that same mastery, that same dominance. So once we connect the person to that spiritual reality, then there is a clinical process that that person needs to go through. There's something about the nature of addiction that makes the addicted one the center of the family, however irresponsible that person has become. He still becomes the center around which everyone rotates, because everyone now has to adjust their lifestyle according to the presence of that affliction and that afflicted one. He controls the whole family. So what I would suggest to whoever would come to me like that is not to be an enabler, which means you can't change your schedule. You can't alter your regular behavior or anything that you do to accommodate what that afflicted or addicted person is doing. You have to go on in the same manner, as difficult as that may sound to do, it has to be done. Then you take the reins of power from the addicted one. And once they see that they're not having any effect at all on the family, then that person has to deal with self. He has to deal with not being able to come back to the same environment and be forgiven or accepted. That's hard to say, it really is, but that's the reality. Because when you accept it, forgive and accept and forgive and accept over and over again, you're just enabling the person. You have to allow that person to reach rock bottom until he comes or she comes to the reality that there's no place else to go but up. But they have to come to that reality. You can't bring them to that reality.
Yeah.
But of course, and, again, and you know it's connecting them with the God.
Well, and
the God himself.
And you're absolutely right, because there were numerous times I was sharing with my sister. There are numerous times my mother is on drugs, and she's been on drugs for years. And there were numerous times when we wanted her to come to certain realities, but we had to realize that we could not bring her to those realities. She'd have to come to them herself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay, so,
and then
let me ask this.
Go ahead. Now, I was just going to say, and then the family members have to get counseling as well, because they now have become victimized by the same addiction. They're just not using. So they have to get counseling as well as to how to deal with it.
Okay. I guess I dropped the ball on that one. I'm talking about myself.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. And, And, you know, I tell people all the time, I am not the perfect example, because those people who know me well, they know my story. They know I was married for 22 years to my first husband, and he was highly addicted to, you know, he fell victim to the crack cocaine wave, because that's what it hit us like a wave. It just, one day he was normal, the next day he was strung out. And so, you know, I incorporated you gentlemen into this topic because I can look back and see some of the things that I personally did wrong. But the meat of this topic is marriage and addiction, because you have people who have taken a vow for better and for worse, and in sickness and in health. And those of us who are counselors or clinicians like myself, we understand that the addiction is a sickness. And it may not be necessarily understood by the spouse of a person. And so you have someone who is not only fighting to save the physical life of a person who is addicted to drugs, but also in the process of trying to save their marriage, because there are some very awful things that can occur during addiction, like the absence of money, so to speak. I say the absence of money because it just disappears. And, you know, then there's trust that has been violated. There are behaviors associated with substance abuse, even infidelity, because you don't have your conscious mind, the deceptive intelligence takes over, and you justify your behavior because maybe your wife rejected you because, you know, of everything that is going on. So you justify going out, you know, having an extramarital affair, or the drugs just give you the courage to do something that maybe you all, you know, you already wanted to do, but your self-accusing spirit kind of held it at bay. But when you're under the influence, you carry out what I call that dirty deed. And so understanding the sickness of substance abuse, when a woman or a man is torn about what to do within that marriage, what is the advice? I'll start with you, Bishop Davis.
Wow. Well, you know, it's easy to say, you know, stick it out and stay. And usually in most Christian traditions, you know, that's what we tell our congregants, you know, when they have issues like this. You know, we bring up that it is for better or for worse. And sometimes I think we wrongfully guilt them into staying into a situation that is really more harmful than good. You know, I tell people all the time, you know, it is never the will of God for you to be mistreated or hurt. So, you know, if a spouse was to come to me sharing with me, you know, these items about their spouse and the different things that you just mentioned, you know, while I would, of course, always lift up prayer, you know, asking God for his divine intervention in their lives. I also try to help people view reality, because reality is very important, you know, when dealing with situations. It's just like my brother just said, you know, don't enable the person. So what is the reality? Are you enabling them in any kind of way to continue, you know, in this you know, downward spiral that they may be going through? But at the end of the day, you know, I always, even in giving spiritual guidance, you know, and sharing prayer and scripture and so on and so forth, I always let the person know this decision has to be yours. If you deem to walk away from the marriage or walk away from the person, only you know what you can and cannot take or what you can and cannot deal with. Only you know what you have already taken, what you have already dealt with. So while I can admonish people with the Word of God, admonish them with prayer, admonish them with doing their best to try to hold their spouse up in the sense of remaining faithful to the spouse, you know, and honoring their vows, I also have to admonish them with reality and with real life circumstances. And sometimes situations don't work out. Sometimes marriages end. I am not in the business of trying to hold a person hostage or make them hold themselves. Let me say that. I'm not in the business of trying to make them hold themselves hostage in a situation where a person has decided, because when a person gets on drugs, you know, while, you know, they may have been escaping whatever emotional pain or hurt or whatever the reason was they turned to drugs, they chose the drug over their spouse. They chose the drug over their marriage, over their family. So I am not in the business of making people hold themselves hostage or guilting people or making people feeling guilty about, you know, whether or not they stay or whether or not they walk away from the marriage. Again, this has to be their decision, and they have to make sure that they are making the decision in a sober-minded state with the best spiritual guidance possible, and that's what I do my best to try to offer. So if a person come to me and share with me several things, you know, depending on, because each case is different, but depending on the case, I may say, okay, well, you know what, you may need to look into getting out of this situation because more harm is coming than help, or more good, more bad is coming than good. So maybe you need to look into getting out of this situation, you know, or make preparations. You know, if you don't feel like the marriage can work out, or you can't trust the person any further, you know, or you know, the infidelity is just too much for you to deal with because of the drug abuse or whatever the situation, they have to make that decision. And so that's always my admonishment. You know, give them the best spiritual advice, give them the word of the Lord, offer prayer, offer my support, but in the same token, offer reality also. And I think a lot of times in many Christian traditions, that's the problem. We sell people false realities. You know, the word is good, you know, but you can, you know, reality is reality, and we have to face that as human beings.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Bishop Davis, for that. And Brother James.
Yes, ma'am.
Your advice.
You know, I have to say quite honestly that I am a beneficiary of someone who had the patience, who had the tolerance, and went beyond their threshold of pain so that I could ultimately, by the blessing and mercy of God, be healed and redeemed and still have my family intact. Having said that, let me say this, that when a person becomes addicted, then the spouse has the responsibility of taking the reins of power in their hands. taking the reins of leadership and rulership, male or female, in their hands. If you're single, if there are no children, then you have the responsibility to take back or to take up your own leadership of self. It doesn't mean a dissolution of the marriage as such. It means that you shut down access. Because as long as the addicted one has access, what that tells the person is that they still can do what they're doing and have access. So you have to shut down access. That doesn't mean you have to get a divorce or walk away from a commitment. No, but you do have to shut down access. Now, from the spiritual sense, which of course is the root of it all, because addiction is not necessarily the disease, addiction is the symptom. Drug abuse is not the disease. Drug abuse or alcohol abuse or substance abuse is symptomatic of something else that is missing in the person's life, or something that is present in the person's life that needs to be extricated from their life. But when a person becomes addicted, then their partner most definitely has to take responsibility for themselves, and if they're children, of course, if they're children, they now have to take the reins, the total reins of leadership, because the other person cannot be trusted to do so. I am a firm believer. Now, I'm not a believer. I am a knower of God's power. I don't care what you're addicted to. God can change it overnight. There's no question about that. The question is, does he do that in every situation? The answer, of course, is no. For his own good reasons, he'll do it in certain situations with certain people. Maybe he has something for them to immediately do for him. Maybe he has something that he wants the person to immediately do for someone else who is the object of God's desire. So he'll use the person, heal the person overnight in the twinkling of an eye. He has the power to do that. There is no question in my mind about it. But that is rare.
Sure.
That is rare. So what happens now with the addicted person is that, again, they become the center of attention. Everything happening in the family now is as a result of or centered around that addicted person. So again, the spouse has to take the reins of rulership and leadership of the family, no question about it. And access has to be cut off immediately. And the person has to see they have no access. This is totally unacceptable. If you don't go get help, and they have to get help. There's no question about it. They have to get help. But these drug rehabilitation programs, their success rate is like 1 out of 10, 2 out of 10 maximally. They don't have a good success rate because it's an outside influence wherein the cure has to come from the inside. They say that you can never be cured of an addiction. So when you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter how long you have abstained from alcohol, you have to introduce yourself as an alcoholic. That's crazy. If you're going to be healed, I don't mean to say that like that, but if you're going to continually tell yourself that you are something that you are trying not to be, how then can the mind negotiate that? If I'm trying to be something but continually tell myself I am that as a prerequisite to not being that, can't you see how contradictory that is? I have to have the frame of mind that I'm not that, or that I am that. So I have to immediately buy into I'm not that. And once I buy into that I'm not that, the mind is so powerful. That's the seat of God. If you can convince the mind that you are not that, you will not be that. So in Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, and I'm well familiar with both institutions, what they do is they assign you, I forgot the name of it, you know, or the name of the person, but the one you call when you feel like using. And they say that you should have a higher power, a higher power. Well, yeah, I agree with that. But let me qualify that agreement. You have to have the higher power. And if you can call a person, then you can call God. You just have to have that kind of connection with him.
Yes, sir.
And if you can call God, then God don't play with you. He don't take you through 12 steps. He don't take you through 10 steps, 4 steps, 5 steps, or 3. He takes you through one step, which you've already taken, is to call him. But you've got to believe in him. And he can absolutely heal you from addiction. Everyone that I know that has come to the Nation of Islam with an addiction, they have healed from that addiction cold turkey. Everyone that I know, and I know quite a few after being in the Nation 41 years, and myself being one who came to the Nation addicted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the clinical aspect, and I'll close on this point. The clinical aspect of it is, which is also very important, the clinical aspect is the person, first of all, must be blocked from access. The person has to see that they have jeopardized everything. They can't even have an inkling of a thought that they got away with it. Or are getting away with it. They have to be cut off. And that's hard to say, but that's what has to happen. And they have to go get help. And if they're willing to get help, and as they progress into health, the access gradually opens back up to them.
Okay, gentlemen,
yeah,
I do so apologize. I'm sorry. I don't know what happened. My phone went out, and the audience was telling me they could hear you, but I couldn't hear you. I couldn't hear you at all. And so if I talked over anyone, I am so sorry because I couldn't hear Bishop Davis or you, Brother James, at all. Somebody told me that Blog Talk is hating on me. I know. The ratings
well,
are on the roof, and I apologize.
Hey, listen.
But I am so sorry.
That's all right.
Okay,
that's all right.
But Brother James, please, go ahead and continue. I'm sorry.
You know, I'm actually finished, and I heard my brother trying to chime in, if I'm not mistaken. I think he was.
No,
okay.
Brother James, I was just amen in everything you said. You know, I agree. I agree 100% with what you said.
Oh, yes, sir. Well, as I said, and you know, in answer to that question, as I close my answer, once again, you know, spiritual connection with God is prerequisitional. That in itself is powerful enough to take away the desire. It is powerful enough to take away the desire, but to maintain abstinence, you've got to involve yourself with people that are moving toward God,
mm-hmm.
that are in a God-based, God-centered movement, whether it's the church, whether it's the mosque, whether it's the temple, or whatever it may be, you have to surround yourself with people who are in a God-centered movement. Because the will has to, you know, the will has to be fed. And it is desire that feeds the will. And it is circumstance, hardship, trial, and levels of difficulty that crush out desire. But when you're struggling with somebody else shoulder to shoulder, I mean, you can draw from them, they can draw from you. When you're purposed with an objective that is God-centered, motivated with an objective, by an objective that is God-centered, then God rides in on that focus, that motivation, that desire, that will, and he's there with you in all that you do. And that's him. And I'm telling you, it's a magnificent thing, you know. And it's a wonderful thing. So there is the clinical process that's very, very important. But as the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, the root of the black man's problem, and I would say by extension, all fallen humanity's problem, is a spiritual root, a spiritual problem.
Yes, sir. Okay. So here we go. I have a sister who is trying to figure out how she is enabling her spouse. And I want the listening audience to understand that process. And when I was talking to her, and she knows who I'm talking about, and of course we're going to leave her anonymous, but she asked me to do this broadcast. I just want to go over some of the signs and symptoms of relapse, because we all know, okay, once you find out they're addicted, you know now you have a good idea, explanation of where all the money is going, where he or she is all hours of the night, and, you know, now you understand, you know, some of the behaviors associated with addiction. But now, you as the spouse becoming an enabler. And the thing about it that sometimes we go to drug rehab, we stay 10 days, they come out, they think they're ready, you know, and, you know, all of a sudden there's a burst of temper, or, you know, you inquire about their well-being, you know, how are you doing today or something, and they just go off, and that's the reason for them to leave the house. And now you're up twiddling your thumbs all night because you don't know where he or she is going. And so what happens is that you take on this behavior that you want to pacify, that you want to console, that you want to comfort. You don't want to make them upset. You don't want to ask them any questions. You want to show them that, you know, you want to encourage them that they can do it. So you trust them with a little bit of money now. And in your heart of hearts, you know what they're going to do. So I'm going to ask you, Bishop Davis, and you have, I'm pretty sure you witnessed this with your own mother. How do you avoid being an enabler?
Wow, you're asking some hard and good questions tonight.
I'm sorry.
A lot of times, and Brother James, you know, he said it real clear tonight, you know, you really have to, you know, shut down all access. The only thing I would chime in to say to that particular statement is it's easier said than done, because these people are family. You have relationship with them. And even though they've made, you know, the bad or the wrong choice of, you know, choosing drugs above your relationship, for whatever reason they chose to do it, there are times where your heart strings are pulled, because at the end of the day, this is your family, and you love them. So there's a process there of you, you know, learning how not to be an enabler, because they're going to do whatever they can to make you feel guilty about you not feeding their addiction, about you not trusting them, you know, with money. You know, they're gonna make you feel bad. They're gonna probably belittle you. It's difficult, you know, to come to a place there, but you have to have what we in Christendom say. We use the word stout. You have to have a very stout heart, you know, when it comes to dealing with family members who are addicted to drugs, you know, and we have to learn how to say no, and be all right with saying no. No, I'm not going to help you. No, I'm not going to leave you in my house without me being there. And just, you know, it's not a secret that they're on drugs. Everybody knows they're on drugs, more than likely. So don't be afraid, you know, to voice what is already known. You know, don't spare their feelings. You know, they're not sparing your feelings, you know, because they're still doing the drugs. And they know how it makes you feel. And even though it is an addiction, and even though a lot of times, you know, they can't just readily pull away from it, they still know how it makes you feel. Because most drug addicts will tell you, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do it. You know, they'll go with the excuse, I just can't stop. And there's a part of them that probably does not want to do it, you know, and then there's a part that probably doesn't know how to come away from it. But, you know, you have to learn how to have a stout heart. I'll never forget when I was a little boy, I was going into a teenager then. For a brief period, my mother was off drugs, and we decided to go. My grandmother decided that she needed a break, you know, because she was raising, you know, my mother's children. And we went to live with her during the summertime. And that was the first time that I could recall that she had ever held down a house. You know, she had ever had her own place to stay. And I'll never forget being there that summer. One day I was asleep. And while I was asleep in her house, she stole the watch that I was wearing off my arm and sold it for drugs. Then I recall being there another time where me and my brothers and sisters came downstairs and the whole house was open. All of the doors were open. All of the lights were on. All of the furniture was gone. Everything was, the refrigerator was blared open. There was nothing in it. Everything had been taken out of the house because she had sold it for drugs. So, and we would, you know, I was just a teenager then. So then I learned very early that because of where she was with this addiction, I could not trust that she wouldn't hurt me. So I had to learn how to have a stout heart. I had to learn how to have a stout heart. I had to learn how to say no. And then I had to be all right with me saying no, and not allow her to run a guilt trip on me because I said no. So that would be my admonishment. You got to learn how to say no, and you got to be all right with it. And you can't let it plague you, you know, or allow, you know, certain thoughts to come to you about, oh, well, you know you could do this, you know you could do that. No, you can't allow that to happen. You cannot allow your emotions to get the best of you when it comes to, you know, family who's on drugs. You cannot. So you have to have a stout heart, and you have to know how to say no, and you have to be okay with it.
Yes, sir, and I think that's the key point, is the not feeling guilty, because we feel sorry and we get that mixed up. You know, we empathize and sympathize, but we get that mixed up and we start to have that pity, that allows us to feed into their guilt trips, and that is the worst thing that you can do. So if you say that you love your addicted spouse, then that tough love has to come to the surface, and you have to say no, and you have to say it with the mindset that I'm doing it to save your life, or I'm doing it not to be a partner in your destruction. And you have to stand on your square and just represent that every day of the week. And like I said, I failed miserably because my tolerance was none.
Not only to save their lives and to not be a part of their destruction, but to also give you some relief. To give you some relief as an individual. Because after doing for a period, you're going to feel like they're just using you, which, in reality they are if you keep saying yes.
Right, and I think the hardest thing is that, like I say, in this situation, when faith comes into play and a person's faith has convicted them to stay devoted to the marriage because there is no signs of infidelity, but at the same time, you're catching hell. And so everybody is not cut from the same cloth. And even as a clinician, I could never advise anyone unless they were in danger, unless their children were in danger or their lives were in danger or the person was a danger to themselves. I could never advise anybody to leave their spouse. But the horror of it all.
Yeah.
Getting through the horror of it all. So I'm going to ask you, Brother James.
Yeah.
When they go through the horror, and I'm talking about when the groceries and the jewelry and the TV and all of those things come up missing, and when, all of the money is spent, and now the emotions come into play because you're hurt and you're disappointed. How does one remain, or does one remain in the marriage? And I know, I shot my husband because he broke in the house, and that's just the truth, because he was just that far gone. He was just that far gone. And so it's tragic to... But in family, to have to go through that. So how do we stay married through it all? Because we took the vow, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health, for rich or poor, forsaking all others, to death do we part. How do we do that? So I'm going to put that one on you, Brother James.
Well, yeah. Thank you, dear sister. I would say this, as marriage is a process, then the dissolution or divorce of marriage is also a process. It's not the first step resolution or answer to a problem, to any problem that rises up in the marriage, up to and including addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a process. Now, in the process, there are necessary steps to be taken to avoid it, to ultimately avoid it. Again, first of all, you don't give an addict money. You don't let them have access to money at all. The only money that they should have is the money that they go out and get themselves, but not from you. Or any family member. Because once that person can get money, the person they're getting the money from is an enabler. And in terms of trust, trust is out the window immediately. And it's not, of course they're going to appeal to you to trust them, that they're okay, that you know, they hadn't used in a few days. And I don't know, by the way, I don't know of any drug program that is a program that lasts 10 days. But, you know, trust is out of the window. You know, there is no trust. And it's not that you distrust them, you distrust the disease. The sickness is what you distrust. So you don't give an addict money. I want to share with you that when a person is in a state of addiction, do you know staying clean for a period of time is a reason, a motivation to use again? It's a celebratory motivation. Well, I've been clean 30 days. You know, I need to go out and reward myself. But, no. That's why I say you have to cut off all access.
Uh-huh.
You know, the woman that is addicted to, the woman that is married to the brother or man that's an addict, she has to cut off all access.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds cold, I know. But she has to, because what has to be conveyed is that you have entered into a situation where you have lost, not are going to lose, you have lost everything. That's what has to be conveyed. And once that is conveyed, the quicker it is conveyed, then that's the quicker the person will hit rock bottom and realize that they've lost everything. And then they'll start either dying or moving to the top, moving upward. But you have to close off access to everything and immediately. And most of the stories that you will hear in counseling is that, you know, the person was addicted, they were given a chance and they went out and did it again. They were given a chance and they went out and did it again. Because that's what addiction is, the repetition of some act from which you can't, for whatever reason, extricate yourself. It's repetition that you can't stop doing it. That's the nature of addiction. That is what it is by definition. You got to do it over and over and over again. The cure for addiction has to be 100% on the addicted person's shoulder. They have to see that this is all me. I have to do it. No one else can do it for me. I have to do it. So it has to be between them and God.
Right. And I'm going to tell you that I can bear witness to the fact that every addict that I've treated, that I've counseled, that was when they actually maintained a good length of sobriety. And when I say a good length, it's because they are still sober today, but their
mm-hmm.
faith is what brought them to that level of sobriety. Because when you are compelled to go into treatment because the courts have mandated you for treatment, you're not going to be successful because you're not doing it for you. You're doing it
mm-hmm.
because it's been demanded of you by some system, whether even if it's your wife, and she, even if she says, if you don't go to drug rehab, this I'm leaving you. So you go to drug rehab just to appease her, and you get, you know, a week, 10 days, 60 days, whatever it is, up under your belt. But in your heart of hearts, your desire to use is still there. And so as you've heard Brother James and Bishop Davis mention the bottom is when you can't go on, when you have gone as far as you can go.
That's
and there
right.
is nowhere else for you to go. That's
mm-hmm.
what your bottom right. is. I've seen full, what I call full grown, and that means smoking crack 24 hours a day. I've seen full-grown crackheads. I call them crackheads. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Addicted persons just throw away massive amounts of drugs because they were at their bottom. They couldn't get high no more. They realized they could smoke till the sun come up and they wasn't getting high anymore. They were just going through the motions. And so when they get to that bottom, and no one can choose that bottom for them but them.
That's right.
You may want to say that, you know, haven't you had enough? Look what you've done to me. Look what you've done to the children. Look what you've done to our family. Look at the state of our finances. They don't care. But when your soul gets tired, every person I know that is recovering from drugs is because their soul got tired. You got tired of getting beat up by playing a game that you can never win. And what I want to say to the people who are married to someone who is an addict, the only thing that you can let them go through it. Because compelling them to stop is not going to work. They have to go through it. You know, you can threaten them. You can incarcerate them. I've seen people locked up for years, and come right out and start using. And you don't understand it. You don't understand how you've been locked up 10 years. You come out, and the first thing you want to do is get high. You know you're on parole. You know that there's a probability that you're going to return to prison because you're going to have a dirty UA, and you use. And that is because there's a desire there that no one but the addict understands, but they have to come through it. So what I want to tell my sister is that at this point in time, for you and your babies, you got to do what's best for you. And because what victims of substance abuse users don't realize is that you become an addict too. You become addicted to being miserable. You become addicted to putting up with things that you know you wouldn't normally put up with, all for the sake of marriage. But that's not marriage. You have to survive first, because if you don't survive, what about the children? What about your very being, your very peace of mind, your sanity? You have to survive first. And this is the other thing I want to say, because these things do happen, unfortunately. Now, Brother James, you're going to have to help me with this one, because I'm not that good a Muslim yet.
What are you
I'm just telling
about
you the
this?
Truth. I put it like this. The best way I can do it is, let me explain something to you. When I was an intern at Prairie View, and I went to the VA hospital in Houston, Texas, as an intern, and we were having a group meeting, and this young man was addicted to crack cocaine. And we were talking about some of the losses that had occurred due to the use of crack cocaine. And these were veterans who had been in rehab for a little while, had 30 days sobriety or more. And I'm a young woman, young counselor, intern, and this young man gets up and he says, "The worst thing crack cocaine made me do was rape my niece, who was 3 years of age." Now, like I said, Brother James, I ain't that good a Muslim yet. But my reaction was not ladylike. I got up and I cut them out. And I told them, no, it gave you the courage to be what you already are. You are a pervert. And that was not the word I used, but that's what I said, basically. You're a pervert. And so what I was saying, I said that to say this. There are things that occur under the use or under the influence of drugs, and I'm talking about specifically infidelity. Now, Brother James, we believe in the process of atonement. But is it possible? I know it is, but is it probable to successfully atone for behaviors such as infidelity under the influence of drugs? And I'm going to leave that like that.
Well, dear sister, people are in relationships right now, every day, that are relationships
yes,
of unfaithfulness, and they know it, but
right,
they're still in the relationship. So it's not only possible, it's probable that you can do it. However, true forgiveness is a process of what you said, atonement. It's not just accepting the reality of the transgression and then saying, I forgive you. No, as the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan pointed out to us and offered us the 8 steps of atonement, there has to be procedural steps that need to take place in order to arrive actually at restoration of relationships, reconciliation of relationships, not just I forgive you, you know. But yes, you can do that. Certainly you can. Infidelity, of course, is one of the violations that destroys the marriage process. There's no question about it. But you can forgive infidelity. I think Jesus said it best when in Scripture he said, if you sin in one transgression, you sin in them all. He was trying to tell the self-righteous ones who may have, who acted as if, well, my sin is less than yours. But Jesus
right,
had to straighten them out. Well, if you violated one, you violated in them all. Because none necessarily are less or more than the other. So you can forgive. I mean, look at the nature of forgiveness. What are the limitations? Where in the Bible does God say this is an unforgivable sin? And it's now they do say that in the Quran, that there are sins that just God just ain't going to forgive.
Right.
One of which is putting another God before him. There's no question that there are some that are unpardonable. He just will not accept it. He will not pardon you. And he says as much. However, sure, I mean, people are in really, I venture to say, dear sister, that there are many, many, many thousands of, you know, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of relationships that are still going on, where infidelity has taken place not only once, but twice, three times, four times in some cases, but there's still...
Oh, you're making my stomach hurt. Okay.
Yeah, but that's it's just a harsh reality. It's the truth.
Oh, no.
Now, there may be reason. It may not be as a result of them forgiving. It could be because the person feels trapped or the person is just totally naive or the person is victimized. I mean, there's a host of different reasons why a person will stay in that relationship. But again, infidelity is not the violation. The violation is what led to it.
Right. And that's what I'm saying. You have to get to a point of understanding.
You have to look at why infidelity takes place. And I remember the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan saying, well, if you don't want adultery, he said, close the door, close the window, which parenthetically he's saying, look, you know, if you don't want it, close down the avenues by which these things occur, the circumstances, eradicate the circumstances under which they occur. And that's why when infidelity is identified or confessed, well, you have to do some counseling. How was the marriage? How was the relationship? What's going on in the relationship? What's missing in the relationship? These are things that, you know, you really need to get to the root of so that you can properly counsel. So, to that degree, you know, you can forgive infidelity. You know, you can. The question is, will you? Violation. Adultery in the Islamic world is a sin that you die for.
I know. Exactly.
You know, in the Islamic world, you once you found guilty of adultery, you are killed. And the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan said that is so because the adulterous act murders the institution of family.
That's
it
right.
Murders the institution of marriage. So,
let me put a disclaimer out there. Hold on. We are not telling you that we, as members of the Islam, go around killing our spouses.
Oh, no. I was going, hey, you let me finish because I certainly was going to make that.
I was going to
make that absolutely clear. None of us right now are pure enough, clean enough, righteous enough, sinless enough to enforce that kind of rule on anybody. But that day is coming. That day is coming. However, so the short answer is yes, you can forgive. But I want to address a point, dear sister, that I don't know whether or not it has been addressed because I came on late. But you got to look at the motivation of those who created these designer drugs. Those who understand the effect that drugs, particular drugs, have on the human being, on the mind, and why they purposely flooded the black community or any community with them. These designer drugs are designed to escalate the activity of the pleasure centers of the body, the pleasure centers of the mind, that where normal activity exists, that allows the person to experience a certain level of pleasure, a certain level of well-being. Well, these drugs are designed to escalate and make more rapid that activity. They're designed to do that. They're not designed for you to heal from. They're not designed for you to stop using them once you use them. There's no such thing as a designer drug made by those who designed it for casual use, for recreational use. No, they designed it so that you will always use them. So what has to happen is to understand what these things, these drugs, do to the mind, how they operate. In the Holy Quran, Satan says to God, or Allah, that since you have caused me to remain disappointed, I'm going to lie in wait for them in thy straight path. Now, that straight path has many levels of definition. It means in the path of religion, that path of faith expression. Yes, Satan is there. He's in the church. He's in the mosque. He's in the masjid. He's in the temple. He's sitting right up on the pulpit. He's sitting in right up in the minbar. He's preaching every Sunday, every Wednesday, every Friday. Oh, yes. He's there because he said he would be there. So that straight path is there, and the condition of the world bears witness that he's there. However, that straight path also means in the very nature of the man you created. That's where I'm going to be. So the satanic mind is using our nature, what we naturally do, against us. And those designer drugs are used to naturally escalate what naturally takes place to such degree, or heighten what naturally takes place to such degree that you can't achieve it in the natural course of life's activities. But once achieved, you long for it.
Yes, so, absolutely.
So, I mean, these are wicked demons of science that have implemented, that have created. It wasn't no brother in the hood, in Compton, or in the ghettos of Bed-Stuy or East New York, or in Cleveland, or, you know, it wasn't no brother that sat down in his lab in his laboratory and designed these things, crack and other stuff like that. No, he didn't know that. This brother probably, if he got a D in chemistry, if he even took it.
Well, Brother James, let me say this, how we started, because I understand what you're saying, but how we started was the statistics of drug use. And, of course, you know, growing up in Compton, you know, it was all everywhere, you turned. But the decision to use drugs, because you have a lot of people that came out of South Central that never used drugs, and then you have a predominant population that did choose to use drugs. And so growing up in the Nation of Islam and growing up with a house full of FOI, it was just never an option for me, but my neighbor's children, some of them, I don't know how far they went, dabbled, in drug use and things of that nature. So we started out talking about the pain that one may be suffering that causes them to medicate. Whether it's something that happened to them or whether it's peer pressure, because children are very impressionable when they're young. And so those things, if they are severely teased or taunted by their peers, that is emotional trauma to them. So they give in to the peer pressure to feel as though they belong, even though consciously they know that that's not something that they need to be involved in. So we're medicating our pain, and of course, there's not a broadcast I can think about doing that speaks to all of our pains, but it's the decision to use any kind of drug, whether it's alcohol, whether it's marijuana, whether it's cigarettes, whether it's cocaine, whether it's heroin, whatever it is, the decision to use drugs as a source of recreation, as a source of medicating your pain, that is the main reason, that is the key reason why most addicts use. And so we have to find better methods of resolutions to our problems. But then when we get in that position, when we get to the point that we are addicted, then we as a people have to know how to deal with the addiction, have to know how to deal with our families, and especially with our spouses.
Yes.
Okay, I don't know
yes.
if someone has
yes.
their speakerphone on yes. or their computer, because I'm getting mm. some feedback. But I just
yeah,
want you to know
too.
That's kind of where we started.
well, let me
with,
say this, dear sister. Let me say this. You know, I want to address that, but I want to give my brother Bishop Davis, right?
Yes.
Brother Bishop, you know, I want to give you the opportunity to weigh in on these things, but I'd like to address that point, dear sister. I really would. So, Brother Bishop, if you'd like to weigh in on it. Yeah.
Well, like I said in the beginning, you know, when we start talking about the statistics and in elementary and secondary schools and how high the drug rates were, the drug abuse rates were, just in elementary and secondary. And, of course, you know, I was taken aback because, you know, that's extremely high. 40% is extremely high. But the point I was making earlier was about us rallying around our children, you know, stepping up for what is right when it comes to our children when we see them going down the wrong path. And the average black family, pretty much every black family can attest to having somebody on drugs in their family, at least one person. So we have to, just like I stated earlier about us rallying around our children and, you know, stepping up for what is right, the same has to happen in our families. We have to learn how to come together as a people and make sure we are doing what we can to offer help in whatever way to these individuals in our families who need help, who desire it. Of course, you can't force it on anybody, but who need and desire help when it comes to getting off drugs, you know, and it's not an overnight process. You know, Brother James stated it, you know, there was somebody who stayed with him or who endured past what they had to, you know, in order to give him whatever opportunity he needed. So, you know, it you know, like I said earlier, it goes to, you know, what sacrifices we're willing to make. You know, when it comes to my mother, yes, I have a stout heart, you know, in regards to her. But you know what? I would do anything to see her come off drugs. You know, and to this day, she's still on them. And I'll be 35 in a couple of days. So yeah, I want to see her off. I want to see her off drugs. And if I can do something to help her get to that path, you know, whatever it is, yeah, I'm willing to do that. And more of us as African Americans, as black people, we have to stop turning a blind eye or a deaf ear to this problem in our families,
yes, sir.
in our communities. We cannot just think, you know, if we close our eyes, you know, the nightmare is going to be over. We're going to wake up and everything's going to be a bed of roses. Because this problem, this drug issue, and it's in all walks of life with all nationalities, all ethnicities, but it's very prevailing in the black community. It's very prevailing in the African-American community. And Brother James is right. You know, this is not something we, you know, that, you know, in South Park or Sunnyside or Third Ward, you know, sat around and came. No, these are drugs that were made to keep us on it.
That's right.
To keep us coming back to it, you know. So we have to find a way as a people to combat that. Because at the end of the day, these are these are our brothers and sisters. You know,
these are
family members. These are our loved ones. And while we may not be immediately related to every single one of them, the fact of the matter is we're still brothers and sisters. We still have, because God is our creator. You know, he's our father. So we have to be passionate. We have to be passionate about doing whatever we can as a community, to rid our communities of this issue, whether it's cocaine, heroin, whatever it is, rid our communities, rid our families of this, what I would better call this demonic force, this demon that plagues black people.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. And to you, Bishop Davis, I want you, if you would, ask your mother that question. You said you never thought about asking her. So ask her, you know, what led her to drugs, because maybe it will give you some sense of peace, because a lot of times our parents don't share their tragedies with us. You know, they don't share it.
Sure.
And by her using drugs as a source to medicate her pain, it might be something that she still has not come to terms with. And sometimes pride and ego comes into play, and we don't want to own up to the fact that we were once victims, and you remain a victim as long as you give the victimizer the power, no matter what it is. It could have been something very major. It could have been something very minute to you, but it was devastating to her. So we never know the source of one's pain unless we begin to ask. And I know you might not be familiar with the process, but the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan has implemented auditing for those in the Nation of Islam to really go back and revisit, for the lack of a better expression, Brother James can talk better on that than I can, the hurt and the pain of things that we have suffered and we are suffering from, because our behaviors are reflective of some of the things that we have been through and some of the things that we are holding on to. And so we give that portion of our past so much power that it dominates our very lives today. And it could have been something that happened 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and we are still holding on. So, it is my prayer, dear brother, and I didn't know you were such a young man, Bishop Davis. You my children's age, my goodness. But ask your mother, because you are blessed to still have her here.
Absolutely.
Ask her, and you will get an understanding, and I promise you it will strengthen your relationship, because nothing strengthens a relationship like understanding. Nothing.
Absolutely. I believe that. And like I said earlier, you know, that's the first time I really ever thought about that. And I know, you know, none of my other family members, because we've never talked about it. And we've talked about numbers of different things, of course, because she's not the only family member we have on drugs. However, she is the center always is some, you know, as Brother Jay says, she's always usually the center. And so, you know, but we've never took time to stop. At least I know none of her five children have, and we're all grown now. And we've never taken time to stop and ask, why is she on drugs? Or what led her to do this? You know?
Right.
So, yeah, I thank you for that, and I definitely will.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Bishop Davis. Okay, and let me remind the listening audience, I'm so sorry. I didn't take your questions, and I'm going to tell you why. The reason why I didn't is because there are so many, and I'm by myself tonight, and having to host and engage my panelists and try to take questions from you all, it was just very difficult tonight, and the phones are tripping, but I see all of you. If a few of you who have not given up are on the phone lines, press one on your dial pad, and we will take your question in these last few minutes. Those of you in the chat room, I promise you, if you email me at either YGBLive@gmail, that's Young Gifted in Black, YGBLive@gmail.com, or Gidget, G-I-D-G-E-T, Muhammad, @gmail.com, I promise I will stay up all night answering your questions if I have to. The word is Vaughn. Okay. Brother James, I know you wanted to make a statement or two about something in particular?
Yes, I did. I wanted to address your expressed concern as to the self-medicating by use or abuse of these drugs or alcohol or whatever to get through difficult situations that people perceive themselves to be in. And in other words, you were talking about why people are using them to medicate, to feel better about themselves or about their situation. And I wanted to address it in this way. The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan has taught us that in biology or physiology, there is 15 pounds of pressure per square inch being constantly pressed upon the human body. 15 pounds of pressure per square inch. And then he poses the question, well, why don't we feel it? Why is it not discomforting us? How do we carry it so well? He said it is because we have an equal amount of pressure pushing out to neutralize the pressure per square inch pressing in. And then he said, for every physical reality, there is a metaphysical or spiritual counterpart. And the reason why we fall in on ourselves, if you will, or are crushed by the prevailing conditions that we find ourselves in is because we don't have answers with which to deal with the questions that arise out of a seemingly unexplained or unexplainable condition. Why, am I black? Why is there racism? Why do we suffer? Why I had to be this way, or why did I have to get into this, or whatever question we may have that motivates us to self-medicate or to find pleasure in quote-unquote recreational drug use. Well, it's the will. The will. This is the one thing that Satan has to destroy in the human being, because it's the attribute of will that makes us God, the independent will that God shares with us, that we can say, I will or will not do something. No other creation can do that but us. It's the will, and our will has been so destroyed as a result of not being able to answer questions that beset our minds, particularly where black people are concerned. What the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's teaching does, as articulated by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, is that it gives us answers as to why things are the way they are, and answers as to why we are the way we are. And what is the nature in which we're created? What is our potential? What did God create us to be? What did he empower us with when he allowed us to come into birth? The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan shared this with us. He said that when the act of birth, the act of procreation or recreation is initialized, the sperm is inserted into the womb. The womb is a hostile environment. The sperm cell, first and foremost, is not by itself. There are 500 million to a billion other sperm cells emitted in the same place with the same objective. He said then the sperm cell, in light of the competition, 500 million to a billion of other sperm cells trying to achieve the same goal, then there's the hostile environment of the womb or the vaginal tract. The vaginal tract environment is such that if the sperm remains in that tract too long, then the acidic nature of the vaginal tract will destroy the sperm. So the sperm cell now is fighting against competition of 500 million to a billion. Then they're also fighting against the oppression or the obstacle of an unstable or hostile environment. Then the sperm has to swim upstream in order to reach the egg. So now the sperm has to fight against the law of gravity. So it has to fight against gravity. It has to fight against the odds of 500 million to a billion, and it has to fight against a hostile and potentially fatal environment. And only one sperm cell can make it to the egg, only one. And once that one reaches the egg, then the egg nature closes up so that no other cell could get in. The minister said, in life outside of the womb, you will never meet the kind of opposition that you had to overcome inside the womb. So God putting you through that opposition as a cell has already equipped you to overcome anything that you might face on the other side of the womb or life itself. So we have in us the natural ability, I don't care what it may be, God has already put in us the natural ability to overcome any obstacle we may face once we come to birth. Now, that's knowledge, and if that knowledge is embraced, accepted, and believed as truth, then whatever the mind can conceive and believe, it most certainly can achieve, because the mind is the seat of God. That's where, that's the residence of God. That's where he resides, in the mind. With that kind of knowledge, when we enter into a challenge, do you think we enter into a challenge to punk out on it? Do you think believing that kind of truth will cause us to bow down to anything that comes against us? This is the kind of teaching that is necessary to empower the human being through will, not a pill, but through will, to meet and overcome every obstacle. And Allah says in the Quran, man was created to face difficulty, not to run from it, not to get around it, but to face difficulty. And then it says in the Arabic language, fa'in me usra usra, it says with difficulty there is ease, meaning that in the difficult situation is actually the ease to that difficulty if we would face it, because God has already empowered us to overcome it once we face it. But the prerequisite is we have to face it. See, that kind of teaching, when that is embraced in the mind and inculcated in the spirit, I mean, then what can anybody do to you? Who can tell you you can't do something or you have to be victimized by something? That kind of teaching is what has empowered all that I have known, and myself definitely, who come with an addiction or an affliction imposed on us by this world. That has empowered us to overcome it, not with clinical help necessarily, not with being spirited away in some isolated, secluded situation such as jail or, you know, being institutionalized, but by accepting the truth. Jesus said, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Well, free from what? Whatever is enslaving you. He didn't give any qualification of it. Free from this but not that. Free from that but not this. No, it will make you free or set you free from anything, meaning there's nothing that can enslave you, nothing that can have mastery over you now if you know the truth. So it's the truth that will make us free. It ultimately is the truth, the knowledge of the truth, and the acceptance of the truth that will make us free and empower us to overcome any addiction or affliction.
Yes, sir. No. Okay, I have to take these questions because I promised. I have a question for Bishop Davis. Brother Bishop, you still there?
Oh, can you hear me? I'm here.
Oh, praise
I'm here.
Allah.
Okay.
I'm here.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Okay. This is from Brother Eddie. Brother Eddie wanted to know, in your study of Jesus and his work, did you find a clinical methodology in his work as well?
In my study of Jesus and his work, is there a clinical methodology?
Yes, sir.
According to Scripture, you know, Christ offers a methodology in, you know, certain deliverances that are to take place in our lives. Whether it is clinical or not, that is something I believe is up to date. But there is a methodology that I believe the Scripture offers when it comes to certain deliverances that we may need to receive, certain paths that we may need to go down as far as our Christian experience. But I would be hard pressed to use the word clinical because that word means, you know, a great deal of things. So there is a methodology. Whether it's clinical or not, that would perhaps, you know, depend on who's reading what Jesus has to say. So that therein lies my answer to that.
Okay. Yes, sir. Thank you. And for Brother James, Brother Eddie, I'm sorry. I can't even verbalize your first question. I'll try to get to it. But Brother James, Brother Eddie wants to know, what do you think were the clinical aspects of methodology of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's first stage of work? Let me repeat that. What do you think were the clinical aspects of the methodology of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's first stage of work?
Okay. Well, well, let's look at the word clinical. Perhaps we can get a better understanding if we.
Hello.
Maybe we need to make Brother Eddie answer, come on the phone. That's what we need to do.
Hello. Hello.
Yes.
Okay, I'm here, but I'm not hearing Brother James.
Brother James? Okay, we lost him some kind of way. Well, you know what? Our broadcast is really over. We're running over. And I tell you what, those of you who have questions, please just go ahead and email them to me. I will forward them to Bishop Davis. I will forward them to Student Minister James, and at their leisure, they will answer the questions. We are over time. I just want to thank the listening audience for joining us again tonight. Please join us tomorrow at 8 p.m. for our live study group, Put on the New Man, of course, with Student Minister James. Join us Saturday for Young, Gifted, and Black at 8 p.m. Central. Join us on Sunday for Economic Development with Brother Vernon at 6:30 p.m. Central. Join us Monday for Conscious Black Nation with Brother Kareem at 8 p.m. Central. On Tuesday, yes, Brother Jihad is back live and living color, and he's on part two, celebrating his first year. And, of course, he's going to be back with Boots on the Ground and the roundtable talks of the time and what must be done on Tuesday at 8 p.m. on Stay, join DJ Black Season and Friends at 7 p.m. And, of course, yours truly, I'll be back next Thursday at 8 p.m. We're going to be talking about Divided by Faith, Part 2. When will our people come together? So, please, thank you. And thank you for joining us. And to my beloved brothers and sisters in the chat room, I love you much and I appreciate you so much. Brother Bishop Zachariah Davis, it has been such a distinct honor and pleasure to have you with us. And we have a rule. You could come on here one time, but you can't just come on one time. So please, sometime in the near future, please join us once again, maybe a different topic, but we would love to have you back. We were so privileged and so honored to have you with us tonight. And I'm going to tell you, I'm just so shocked that you are so well-spoken and to be such a young man and you're so well-studied. So certainly you are a gift to us, among us, and we thank God for you, dear brother. So thank you, and please give the greetings to your family and thank them for allowing you to spend this time with us tonight.
Thank you. I appreciate being here again, and I look forward to us dialoguing again and coming back. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Okay, well, that's it. That's our show for tonight. So may Allah continue to bless us all with knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. One nation, one love. Good night, y'all. Assalamu alaikum.